The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, because we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. The following episode was recorded live at the SkepTrack at DragonCon. Today we'll be talking about women in science and skepticism, and instead of my intro, I'd like to let the women speak for themselves. Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and I am live at the DragonCon SkepTrack. So when skeptical and science-oriented women get together, the conversation often gets around to a discussion of being a woman within the skeptical community. And we tend to talk about issues like how women are treated as skeptics and scientists, the unique pressures that women face, and what can or should be done to help. And these are important conversations to have. But too often the thing that gets overlooked is what women are actually accomplishing despite all those challenges. So on today's episode, instead of focusing on those challenges, we're going to discuss the varied and wonderful ways that women are kicking ass. So I'm going to have the women introduce themselves. Kylie.
My name is Kylie Sturgis. As you may notice, I am an Australian. This is my third year at DragonCon. I'm a teacher of religious education and philosophy in a secondary high school. I am a student of a Master's of Education degree, focusing on the measurement of paranormal belief. I'm a podcaster for both the Token Skeptic and the Skeptic Zone podcast. I'm a blogger at podblack.com. I write for the CSI website for a column called Curiouser and Curiouser. And I think I am the second woman to ever introduce Richard Dawkins to a stage when I was the MC of a global atheist convention.
Yes, do applause.
Now, Kylie actually does research into gender and belief. Can you give us some background on that?
The measurement of paranormal belief, there's been quite a lot done over many, many years. One of the things that myself and a co-researcher, Dr. Martin Bridgestock of Griffith University, tried to do was to see if we can make a new scale of measuring paranormal belief using a variety of scales and including elements on conspiracy theory belief and creationist evolutionist beliefs. For my master's degree, what I decided to do was see if I could find out how well the scale worked, in particular how well it worked in measuring the difference between male and female responses to particular paranormal beliefs.
You can applaud now. And we have a fairly new skeptic, Jenna Marie Griffith.
I'm Jenna Griffith. I'm not Australian, as you might be able to tell. I almost live in Canada, but not quite. I'm actually a graduate student right now in art history, which is something that seems to be rather far removed from a lot of your professions, probably. My actual research focuses on issues of gender and sexuality in 19th and 20th century European and American visual culture. I basically study nude neurotic art, which sounds cooler, right?
You can applaud that.
Right? But I'm particularly interested in issues of cognitive science within those areas. And I was concerned mostly with the lack of critical thinking in a lot of my classes. About 20, 30 years ago when the humanities made the postmodern turn, things got a little shaky. And I said, no, let's just back up. That's not anything that has anything to do with anything. Let's look at it critically, see what the artist actually intended. Let's see what's actually going on in these works of arts and how they're actually affecting people when they look at them, and stop making just assumptions that sound cool and make really cool sentences but don't really get us anywhere to understanding culture at all.
Excellent.
And we have Robin Swoopy McCarthy.
Hi, I'm Robin McCarthy. A lot of people know me as Swoopy. I'm the co-host of Skepticality, which is one of the official podcasts of Skeptic Magazine. I've been doing that since early 2005. And so I never knew that skepticism was a special thing. I grew up with a lot of women who thought that common sense was very important. And I think common sense and skepticism and critical thinking are all part and parcel. And so when podcasting became a new thing, it seemed only natural to talk about the subjects that I love the most. And so the conversations we started having were about skepticism and critical thinking and our love of science. And I've been able to meet so many awesome folks like all of these ladies up here. And what I'm really impressed by is what I've been seeing this weekend and at TAM and at weekends like this about the diversity of people who are now imparting critical thinking and skepticism into areas that you wouldn't have otherwise thought about. I've always found that interesting, and it really seems to be making a surge, and I love to see that.
And you do a little something to do with DragonCon, don't you?
A little bit. Technically, I'm the director of the podcasting track, but there's been a science track at DragonCon for a really long time, I think almost since its inception, and this con has been going on for almost 25 years. And so science has always been important to it, and there's usually a science is a candle in the dark, and now it's evil geniuses for a better tomorrow, I think. But the single skepticism panel that we had in a large room over at the Hyatt was always extremely well attended. And when Derek and I were invited to be a part of that, we felt that it was a great fit, and we started inviting people like Phil Plate and Michael Shermer to come check out this con. And Phil already was familiar with it because of the space track. And so then, you know, everybody we invited were so gracious to come, and like James Randi and everyone else that's been here, and now Adam Savage. And so you're all helping bringing critical thinking to all of these sci-fi geeks that may not have even heard of it before, but science and sci-fi, as we know, go very well together, and so do critical thinking and sci-fi. So Derek and I have been doing this. This is third year of this. Okay. So, and I think it's going really, really well, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to actually persuade Swoopy to be inspiring, which is nice. So follow that up, Heidi.
I'm Heidi Anderson, and I am a domestic violence and sexual assault fundraiser in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And I've been in that field for 16 years. I've always been involved with women's issues. I got involved into skepticism a little bit later, probably, than most of the people up here. I think it was about 3 years ago. And I always joke that it was for bad reasons, because it was from a crush on Penn Jillette. But through that, I actually listened to other people and found out about Phil Plate and DJ Grothy, Point of Inquiry, and started... I came to DragonCon that year and met Derek and Swoopy. Fell in love with them. They're wonderful people. And met Kylie, I think, that first year. And got involved. I started just talking to people on the internet. And then March of this year, I started a new blog called shethought.com, which is a blog for critical thinking, women in critical thinking. And it's a little bit different. I can sometimes get my feelings hurt on the internet with mean commenters. And so I wanted to create a place. It's okay, thank you. I'm better now. But I wanted to create a space where people could come and actually talk about issues and not be screamed at and yelled at and nasty, nasty names. Because I don't talk like that. I think everyone here knows that I have a very clean mouth. And it's yeah. So that's how basically what I've been doing. I'm also one of the co-hosts of Podcast Beyond Belief for the Foundation Beyond Belief, which is a podcast about raising your children without religion. And it's wonderful. Colin and Rob and Lori do a lot of work on it, and I show up. So I thank them for that. And I love these women as well. And I also have another blog called Fat One in the Middle.
So you are a sex educator, but you also do a parenting podcast. So are there any parallels there? Or?
Well, they do now have Sex Talk with Heidi on the podcast. So they had originally said Sex with Heidi, and then we changed the name. So it might improve the listenership, but, you know. Yes, I do a lot of education. In addition to raising funds, I've been in the field for 16 years, but I will also go out into colleges and schools and teach kids about healthy relationships, and that involves healthy sexual relationships, sex negotiation, working with issues as far as dating violence, date rape, and really trying to help kids learn what's healthy and what's not healthy.
So now I'm interested to know how all of you came to be doing all of these wonderful critical thinking activities. Did you have specific role models? And I'm not looking just for women, because a lot of us have male role models. Jenna?
Let's see. I actually live about a 20-minute drive from the CFI headquarters in Amherst. And through somebody who's a very close friend of mine, I became really familiarized with the organization there. And like what Swoopy said, I didn't grow up knowing that skepticism was a thing you could have. I just knew that I had a really low tolerance for crappy thinking. Like somebody would come up with something, and I mean, like I said before, I would always say, "Really? Really? That's what you're going to do with this? That's where you're going with this? Now let's think about this again." And what I realized when I started going to events with at CFI and reading different magazines and looking at different websites and stuff, I realized that this was an entire thing, and you could actually celebrate critical thinking. And I got familiarized with people like Ben Radford and Joe Nickel and their investigations and things like that, and, you know, looking at Paul Kurtz, of course, and Randy and stuff like that, and realized that this was an entire thing, not just me being annoyed with people for not thinking things through. And that's kind of where my foray kind of happened into it.
For myself, as an Australian, like Heidi, some of my first interactions with skepticism was online. And it was through that I met an Australian called Michael McRae, who I very much hope will have a book coming out next year called The Tribal Scientist. And another friend, Dr. Mark Henn, who is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire, and he currently teaches a course in skepticism for undergraduate students in psychology. Otherwise, I guess there's been a few key Australian women who have influenced me. Lynn Kelly, the author of The Skeptic's Guide to the Paranormal, a great book that I sincerely hope is still in print, and I know that she does visit America on occasion, so if you have the opportunity, do catch up with her. And Dr. Karen Stolzner, who is an Australian who has moved to America and is now currently in the San Francisco area. She writes for CSI and has her own blog called Skept Bitch. Apart from that, there's a variety, not unlike yourself, Jenna, women who are involved in different fields beyond just science and skepticism. I greatly admire women like Catherine Donaldson of Faster Pussycat and Donna McGover of Shearbrick Productions. They're both in advertising and both in promotions. And to me, they've very much in more recent years, due to not only interacting with them personally, but seeing their work online and the products that they produce, very much impressed me about how the look of people in skepticism and the look of people in science communication and polishing and improving, not just how we behave towards people, but understanding how we come across. I found that quite influential. So it's not just intellectual, it's the way we come across with a bit of polish at times as well.
I'm Donna McGavro, known as Ms. Information for the Geologic Universe and Vault Keeper. And I work with George Harab, who is a singer, songwriter, podcaster, skeptic, and all-around great guy. I also act as the diva of design for Dark Overlord Media, which is the publishing imprint owned by Scott Sigler and A. Kovacs, and I do interior book design. And I own Shearbrick Studio, which is a full-service, independently owned design shop in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I've been working with George Robb since 1998 on his promotion as a singer-songwriter and CD packaging. In 2007, I believe, he got into podcasting on a suggestion, let's say recommendation, from Slough Hallatin, and we started a podcast, the Geologic Podcast, and George was interviewed by Derek and Swoopy on Skepticality. And I would mark that really as the beginning of our involvement in the skeptic community. And it really took off, and we became extremely interested in providing a platform for George's thoughts on skepticism and critical thinking. I feel honored to work with George in ways that would be hard to describe. I'm very jazzed to provide design and bring a more sophisticated vocabulary to the way things look and the way the message is communicated. I feel like that's my part in this whole thing. Early sites that dealt with critical thinking and science and research, they did look homegrown, and at the time I think that that was a positive thing and was viewed as credible. However, in this very compressed few years, I think that sites have become more sophisticated looking, and I think that George and I are part of that as far as his materials are concerned, and I do believe that this more sophisticated look is in line with how the skeptic community should be perceived. I don't think of myself as being in the background. I view what I do as a conduit. I've always felt that design is really a means of providing a clear and understandable format for the message. If I'm not doing my job, then the message isn't being conveyed in the best way possible or may not be perceived as it's meant to be. For example, I do interior book design. A lot of people ask me, what is it exactly you do? That's a really good question, because if my design were front and center instead of the actual text, I'm not doing my job. I'm taking away from the message with my typographic hijinks. There are probably many people we can't think of right now who are the backbone of these various facets of the skeptic community. The more this grows, the more inclusive and pervasive this is in our society, our community, the more we need people with varied skill sets. There's no way anything organized can run without people who have skill sets that aren't necessarily about research and science. Let me use this as an example, some of the work that Daniel Loxton has done. That's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Any designer would be proud to have produced those materials. One of the things I absolutely love about being part of the skeptic community is that I'm not treated as a woman. I don't think of myself as a woman skeptic. I think of myself as a person, as a skeptic. It's logical. I'm not like, you know, some skeptic dame. I'm a person. It's not my gender first. In my work, in my design studio, I've been doing this forever, and I'm not conscious of my gender until somebody brings it up as an issue. I don't think of myself as a female designer. I'm a designer. And I'm most comfortable when I'm treated as a person.
Well, and unexpected. I think a lot of your examples show that not just women in skepticism, but also particularly women in skepticism, are not what you would expect. Mm. And there is no paradigm, there's no one set thing. I think it's pretty open. I think what's great about the skeptics movement, you can be anybody you want to be, as long as you're, you know, somewhat rational. But even then, everybody is so accepting. And so I think that makes for a very good variety of people to look to in different disciplines. I know Jennifer Ouellette is someone I just adore. And Jennifer works with a filmmaker who's a biologist who studied under Stephen Jay Gould, and his name is Randy Olson. Sarah Mayhew, who was supposed to be here this weekend, who I just adore, she's reaching teenage girls who read manga, comics, and making sure that her protagonist is a good critical thinker. Anybody who's trying to do something new and aren't afraid to do it, and people that are thinking outside of the box to find new ways to tell stories that involve science and critical thinking, I think is somebody to really be admired. And I just always love to say that I love Neil deGrasse Tyson. And so I don't know if I could call him a role model, but I think he's a good role model for everyone in general. But he's certainly somebody I admire and would like to be more like.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Ouellette. I am a science writer. My most recent book is called The Calculus Diaries, How Math Can Help You Lose Weight, Win in Vegas, and Survive a Zombie Apocalypse. I'm also a prolific blogger. I blog at Cocktail Party Physics, and I write for Discovery News. And for the last 2 years, I have been director of a program called the Science and Entertainment Exchange for the National Academy of Sciences to essentially build a grassroots community of getting scientists talking to people in Hollywood to promote better, more positive images in the media. I was an English major and not really into math and science at all, and I also had a fundamentalist Christian upbringing on top of all of that. So when I put all that behind me and moved to New York City, I ended up taking a job with a physics organization, started writing stuff for them, became a science writer, learned about physics that way, and my most recent book is actually about me confronting my math phobia, which I argue really hurt me, particularly in my younger years. Math, particularly when you get to the level of calculus, is about critical thinking. It's about logic. It's about reasoning. And I think that when I was in high school, because I'd had this upbringing, critical thought really wasn't something that was encouraged in our household. I mean, faith was encouraged. I had to develop that late. And I think that was one of the reasons that math never really clicked for me in high school. I could follow the rules, and as long as you gave me a problem that I recognized and I knew a rule existed and I could follow it, I could do well. In fact, I did do very well in my math classes in high school, but deep down I knew I really didn't understand it. And that's very much, I think, a symptom of not thinking for yourself when you're just following a rule. And I think where people run into a wall with something like calculus is that, because calculus is just a tool. You've got to be able to look at the world around you, analyze it, figure out what are the important points, and then encode that symbolically into an equation so you can solve the problem, and then know how to work that. That's extremely difficult to do, and it's incredibly good training just for all walks of life. People keep asking me, well, why do I need to know calculus? And it's not necessarily about applying calculus to a real-world problem. I do that over and over again in my book, but the real point is you're learning how to analyze and test your world. It's actually just, you know, one woman's experiences finding out that the world is kind of her mathematical playground. So, you know, we went to Vegas, and I went to Disneyland, and I went surfing in Hawaii, and I went and looked for calculus there and tried to find ways in which calculus could be applied in those situations. And it was very, very good for me in terms of honing my mathematical thinking. So it's kind of about that. It's less about teaching calculus and more about teaching how to think. I like writing books about my own experiences. I like writing the blog about my own experiences because of that, you know, because I think that I really do know what it's like to come from a tradition where critical thinking is not really key. And I know that learning about physics and getting to know scientists personally really changed my mind about a lot of that and made me realize that this was a dynamic, exciting area to be involved in. And yes, I want to do outreach, I guess, in that respect and let other people like my former self know that this is actually really cool stuff.
When I first got involved in skepticism, again, it was through entertainers. That's kind of what I had expected. And then started reading Phil Plate, his blog, read some of Michael Shermer, and then Richard Dawkins, and just realized that there was like a whole world there. But after Dragon Con, the first Dragon Con, I met Swoopy and Kylie, and it seemed like they never slept. Because Kylie especially, because so they were just constantly doing things. And I'm married. I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old. But I have a husband who is absolutely amazing because he's home with the kids this weekend. Sometimes my job can be very, very busy and very emotionally draining, and sometimes it's less busy. So I had some time where I could also start blogging and research things, and took advantage of that. Once I got involved a little bit more in skepticism, and I think it was last year that Kennedy Goodkey, he named me as like his favorite a-hole skeptic, which is hilarious now. Okay, that's me. But he did, and then I started reading Daniel Loxton stuff, and was just, you know, he's so nice, and he has so many wonderful things to say. And then it was through Daniel that I met Desiree and realized that I did not have to use the F word, every other word, for people to understand me. In the South, I thought that's just what you did. So it was very interesting to me, because I realized that Daniel and Desiree have kind of taught me that your message is far more important than your personality. And if you are trying to actually get a message across versus trying to make a name for yourself, that you really do need to focus on what that message is.
It's all part of the polish. It's all part of making sure you get it right. Yeah.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio. Or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
So what I'd like to know is, who are we missing? We're mentioning women in science and skepticism. Who do you think needs more promotion? Who do you think is doing amazing work within this community?
Nicole Gilucci is the Noisy Astronomer, and she now also writes for Discover Blogs, and she is absolutely amazing. She has a project called Dark Skies, Bright Kids. Absolutely wonderful. I first became aware of the skeptics through once I got involved with skepticism and I realized who they were, read their blog, and I became friends with Elise Anders. And earlier this year, they raised more money than they particularly needed for something, so they had to do something with that money. And Elise got the paperwork together and created the Women Thinking Free Foundation. And one of the things that they are doing with some of that money that they've raised is tomorrow they're having the Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated campaign over at the Peachtree Mall.
I'm Maria Walters. I write for Skeptic, and I run the Atlanta Skeptics.
Hi, I'm A. Kovacs. I write for Skeptic, and I work in a handful of women-forward, science-based nonprofits in San Diego. So Women Thinking Free is actually the brainchild of its president, Elise Anders, who, interestingly, she can't be here because she is a new mom. And because there's a pertussis outbreak, she's unable to come because she can't protect her daughter, who can't protect herself yet. So she had to stay home, but we're really super proud of her, and we're here on her behalf.
Their original goal, they wanted to launch this campaign called Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated, which was going to be a kind of a purely educational thing, talking about vaccine safety and why you should vaccinate and why it's important, aimed directly at parents. And I think her original plan was for it to be really just let's distribute some materials and educate people. And then we got this opportunity here at DragonCon to actually do a vaccine clinic, and it just made so much sense that we decided that now we're doing this as well. And we've already had a lot of people who have come to us through Skeptic and said, we want to do this in our area. It's really an exciting time. This all happened because I happened to meet somebody from the CDC, and I contacted him about 3 weeks ago and said, "Hey, we're interested in doing this. What would it take?" And they jumped on the opportunity. So he got me in touch with the local health folks, and they jumped at the opportunity to get these folks vaccinated because this is really their target demographic. The kind of males 18 to 35 never come in for booster shots. Never know they have to get booster shots. Which is one of the reasons we've had these pertussis outbreaks. So they jumped on this opportunity, and I was just talking to him earlier, and he said that he also has contacts kind of around the country and can probably help us with other people who want to do this. So I think this is the beginning of something very, very cool that we'll hopefully be able to do again and again.
It also reminds me about thinking outside the box. One of the great courses that I had an opportunity to do, which is an online course that anyone can do. It's run by Dr. Caroline Watt of the University of Edinburgh, and it's in parapsychology. Now, for many people who are skeptical, they might hear the word parapsychology and think that's something that we're against, right? I mean, isn't that the belief in ghosts? Well, try this parapsychology course that she offers online, and it is fantastic. She not only investigates those people who are probably more tending towards thinking that there is evidence for paranormal beliefs, but she creates an opportunity to hear both sides. I know that there's interviews and podcasts that she's recorded from both sides of the equation, not just those who are pro-paranormal beliefs, but the likes of Dr. Richard Wiseman, who's been a very strong critic and investigator in terms of what's the relevance of these particular claims that people make. It's an online course. She puts it out there for anyone to do. And for myself as a traveller, this was an excellent opportunity to get a certificate in parapsychology of all things. And I learnt a lot about why people believe as they do, not just from one particular sceptical-minded perspective. And I think that's important too, that we open up and try to find out more about people, because, yeah, there's still questions and there's still things that we're investigating, and we have to be open-minded like a sceptic should be.
So is there anybody else who wants to say anything about skeptical or scientific women on this panel? Because I really want to hear from the audience. Now, one of the things that I find so interesting about Skeptically Speaking is the fact that although the skeptical community has been very supportive, we very much appreciate that, our main audience are not self-identified skeptics.
Yeah.
They are the people listening on the 22 radio stations that we're broadcast on. They are in their cars. They've flipped the station and they've heard it and they've found something of value. And that's who I get emails from. Half of the women, or half of the people rather, that send me emails tell me about these amazing women and these amazing men that I've never heard of before, because I'm quite firmly within the skeptical community. So who don't we know about?
Yes. Hello, Daniel Loxton.
Can I also mention briefly one other woman that I didn't think of, and as Daniel came up to the mic, most people don't know that the bulk of Skeptic magazine is produced by one woman. Did I read your mind?
Yeah. you took it right out of my mouth. Pat Lindsay, the co-publisher of Skeptic. I mention her not only because she's my boss, but also because she co-founded the first North American mass media skeptics anything. And yet very few people know her name, so I hasten to bring it up here.
Well, and because of her support, Daniel was able to publish his children's book on evolution. I mean, she's an art director. She makes Skeptic magazine look beautiful, but she's also... It wouldn't happen if she wasn't there, and she's been doing it all these many years now, and she kind of doesn't sell herself because that's not her. But those are the kind of women that are doing things behind the scenes that are important that you don't hear about. I think those people will also emerge at places like this. I mean, when the weekend's over, you're going to hear from a lot of people who didn't know about this when the weekend started, and they spent the rest of the weekend in here, and now they're way revved up and excited. And so it's creating opportunities for people to come out of the word work and be discovered at Skeptic Camp in schools everywhere. So, you know, nurturing that and making people feel free to be that, to be free thinking and open about beliefs or non-beliefs is what helps bring those people out, I think.
So I figured I'd not hide behind the wireless mic and get up here so people can feel free to come up. But the big woman in my life was my mom. She made me the way I am. Aww. It's true. No. My mom, when I was a kid, she sat me down and made me watch horror movies, mainly because she loves them. And I was like a little kid. I was like 9 or 10 when Poltergeist came out. And she made me watch the entire rated R uncut thing. And she said, okay, we're going to watch it. I was scared out of my mind. And she said, okay, we'll watch it again. And I was like, okay, everything really was scary. And she stopped it. And she said, okay, tell me how they did that. I said, what do you mean? Remember the part on the movie where they had the stake that moved? She stopped it. She said, if you had a camera, how would you do that? She made me go through that entire movie that I hated at the beginning. She made me figure out how they did all the special effects. And then she said, that's how all movies are done. Yeah. All this stuff is fake. Don't be scared of it. Just learn how it's done. And that made me who I am. Because the rest of my life, all that stuff is like, that's not real. I figured out how that happened.
A hand for your mom's, please.
Hurry for your mom. And everyone else.
It doesn't bite. You can just...
Okay, I'd like to nominate Lori Tarr over there.
Oh, yes.
Hi, my name is Lori Tarr, and I am a mom, and I'm a wife. And I'm also a science educator. I teach elementary kids fun science experiments. And in the skeptical community, I am the organizer of the Louisville Area Skeptics. And I am one of the hosts of Podcast Beyond Belief, a podcast for secular parents. It is focused on science-based parenting. It is sponsored by the Foundation Beyond Belief, which is a secular charity. And it is a panel of secular parents who talk about raising free-thinking kids and how to do that using science and skepticism. And I also, every summer for the last 3 summers, have taught at Camp Inquiry, which is a one-week summer camp for secular children, which is held near Buffalo, New York, and it's sponsored by CFI, the Center for Inquiry, in Amherst, New York. I've been skeptical my whole life. I started out in high school really loving science. I had a wonderful science teacher, a physics teacher, Mr. Demery, who really ignited my love for science and for inquiry. And later, as an adult, I discovered that there was a word for what I am, and that's called skeptic. And once we discovered Phil Plait's Bad Astronomy blog, we discovered that what we are is skeptics, and I subscribed to the Skeptical Inquirer magazine and started finding out that there are other people out there called skeptics. And then I found out about Camp Inquiry, and I really wanted my daughter, who at the time was 7, to go to Camp Inquiry, but she was just 7, and I did not want her to go to camp by herself. So I volunteered to go as a counselor myself. And at camp, I discovered that There are all sorts of really interesting people in the skeptic community, and I really wanted to be part of that community with them. One of my lifelong role models would be my mother. She always taught me to think critically, to ask questions, to find out the scientific answer for things. She's a registered nurse, and so any question that I had, she would always make sure that I knew what the science behind it was. I had an older brother who was really into reading, and I remember as a very young child asking a question, and he would disappear into his room for 2 minutes and come back and always have a book that addressed that exact issue I was just talking about. And so my entire family really has helped me in my entire life to learn how to ask questions and to find the answers to them.
I just wanted to throw in that in the area where I grew up, and probably in many areas around the country, most of the school teachers are women. And I know that in my experience, some of my first exposure to critical thinking was in science class. And there are thousands of chemistry teachers and physics teachers and physical science that are indeed mostly women, and they are out there giving many people their first taste of critical thinking because they're not getting it at home. And now that we know that Derek had to watch R-rated horror movies as a child, it explains a lot of things.
Okay, so it's obvious that there are a lot of women in science and in skepticism doing things. So why do we focus on the negative all the time? When we have these conversations, we're always pointing out all of the obstacles, all of the challenges, the sexism, the discrimination. Why do we do that?
One of the reasons, usually when you see the list of speakers at places, I mean, it's a lot of white guys, and it's getting better, I think, every year, but it's still can be, you know, very disheartening.
It's a problem that's gone on for many years, and maybe it's just something that has become more obvious because we have better ways to communicate with each other. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, if you spend, I think part of it is the frustration, because even though there are women that are making a difference and there are women that are visible, we know how many women have yet to be reached, because if you watch like 5 minutes of daytime television,
oh God,
you will see what the problem is.
Now, again, that seems like a lot of negatives. So how do you think that actually affects the people that are thinking about getting into this community? Every time we talk about women, we focus on all of those areas that are negative. How do we make that positive?
I think that one thing we can do, and I can certainly say that I was very guilty of it in terms of a name that I gave a column that I wrote once. It's very easy when women disagree to use the word catfight, like I did in that article. And people don't do that. Like with the disagreements that are going on right now between, you know, it seems to be mainly the male skeptics kind of fighting it out over be nice or don't be nice, you know, that kind of thing. You know, we're not saying, well, they're just being boys. You know, we're not blaming it on their gender. But when women disagree about things, we are very quick to, it's just competition, right? They're just, well, they're jealous of them and they're jealous of them. And we need to realize it's just different women and different ways of doing things.
So do you think that's actually the case, or that's the perception?
It's probably more of a perception than a reality. But I think a positive is still that anyone is welcome. Everyone is welcome. It's wide open. I feel generally these spats that seem to happen periodically aside that are very specific, I think the community as a whole is easier to get into and is more accepting. I mean, that's our whole premise, is we welcome people who don't think the way that we do, because they should be able to learn for themselves with the evidence that we present that, you know, that this is a positive message that we're offering. So, I mean, that I think that's a positive thing. It's wide open. I don't think it's closed, as, you know, shown by the wide, again, diverse women in all different fields. And lots of young women that, you know, all the young women that I saw at TAM this year, college-age women, I don't think it's going to be the same for them.
Jenna, you're new.
Me? Yes. What? New?
So what was the perception that you had of the women in this community?
What I see of the community is that things do get collapsed, as far as women go, they do get collapsed to their gender more than anything else. You don't hear things about the men in the community being talked about as being a man and having their gender and their sexuality put forth first. With women, no matter what, except for a select group of women, except when you get to the rock star sort of women skeptics, women do get collapsed to their gender. They're a chick, they're a bitch, they're whatever they are, and that's the way it's always perceived. That's from the outside, that's the way I saw it. And I think that what we can focus on more is not focusing on that as much. Make it just people. Everybody's everybody. And not create such a
dichotomy.
Dichotomy, yeah, binary. The things that happen that way. Not other the women so much.
I'm very new to skepticism. But I'm finding this. Thank you. I'm actually finding this panel a little strange because on the one hand, you're talking about women skeptics and the dichotomy you just mentioned. On the other hand, just by having this panel and having it all female, you've created that dichotomy.
True.
So mm-hmm. I'm just curious, what do people within the community do to try to balance? On the one hand, you do need to talk about these issues to change them with sometimes talking about them entrenches them. How do you balance the two?
Now, I'd like to say something. That was the point of this show, is to be positive. And look at how quickly it degenerates into all of the negatives about being a woman within this community, which is unfortunate, which is why I guess I want these women's help and I want your help. How do we put a positive face on this while still being able to talk about these issues?
Hi, thank you very much for having this panel. I want to say that we really do need to celebrate the things that make us a different sort of part of the community. You're right about making it all other. I'm a filmmaker and people talk about the female documentarian. It's like, no, mm-hmm. I want to be a good filmmaker and my gender should be irrelevant. So I think that what we have to do is we often sort of second-guess ourselves to celebrate the things like inclusion and our different conversational style. And it's really up to us to be confident in the things that make us different and to create new language. If we don't want the word catfight attached to an intellectual discussion, then we need to set the tone and make sure that word doesn't come up.
Well, then let's make it a different question. Not how do we get more women into the community? How do we bring skepticism and critical thinking to women?
Perhaps just being a person who is a professional in their field and developing their skills and perhaps mixing in the skepticism with it. It takes work, and I guess it's up to all of us in a way to use the variety of skills that we have and try to mix it in with that.
Yeah, I mean, go where they are. I mean, yeah. you are a role model for everyone else. I mean, if nobody knows what skepticism is or if they've never talked to anybody about it, you might be the first skeptic they ever meet.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pamela Gay. I am on the faculty at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. I'm also executive director of Astrosphere New Media Association. And my primary work, I guess, is trying to communicate astronomy out to the public and get them to engage in doing astronomy for themselves. And I do this by working with projects like Galaxy Zoo and Moon Zoo, which are citizen science projects, and by communicating out and hopefully inspiring with Astronomy Cast and 365 Days of Astronomy. People keep asking me how I came to skepticism, and it wasn't so much that I came to skepticism as the Skeptics Track reached out and said, you are part of the Skeptics Track. I'm a scientist, an astrophysicist, but like many people, I had always had the impression that skeptics, it's this thing over here where they're writing they have the psychops and the skeptical inquirer, and they spend lots and lots of time debunking ghosts, and that's really important and amazing work, but I'm really busy with the things I do. But my first time at DragonCon, I was here and friends like Phil Plait dragged me into the skeptics panels and said, no, what you're doing counts. Look at the stuff I'm doing with the moon hoax. Well, you're teaching people so that they don't ever get wrapped up in the moon hoax. And it was through no one person, but by having Derek and Swoopy and Phil and DJ Grothy and Richard Saunders and this whole community of skeptics reach out and say, no, really, you are one of us, that I became part of this community. Saying that I have a role model in skepticism is a bit odd for me. I think for me it's always been about the science, and even there, looking for a role model in science is somewhat hard. Instead of a role model, I think perhaps it's an inspiration. When I was growing up, I read Timothy Ferris's book, Coming of Age in the Milky Way, and read about these female calculators they had at Harvard, who their primary task was to do the calculations that were beneath the men to do. And one of these women, Henrietta Leavitt, she discovered while going through glass plate images of globular clusters that there were these relationships between the brightness of stars and how they varied in light over time. And because of her work, we now know how to measure distances through the universe. And just the fact that noticing something, just realizing, oh, there's this trend here that no one else noticed before, she made it possible for us to measure the universe. And that was an incredibly inspirational thing.
If you are a success in your neighborhood, brilliant for you. I mean, you don't have to be blooming Adam Savage all the blooming time. You know? And I'm censoring myself here, Desiree.
Am I going to have to edit that?
I hope you appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, do the thing that you do that is unique to you. And if critical thinking is a part of it, then utilize that. Talk to your coworkers if it's appropriate. I mean, go where those people are.
I'm Barbara Drescher. I teach cognitive psychology and research methods at CSU Northridge. I write a blog called ICBS Everywhere, and I have a student organization called Woo Fighters. And the mission of that organization is to motivate students to become critical thinking advocates and activists. What really motivated me to start Woo Fighters was I saw a gap. If you go to skeptical conventions and, you know, meetings, what it's really missing is younger people. There are a lot of 20-somethings, but there really aren't a lot of high school kids, freshmen in college, or younger even. And we really, I think, should be reaching down as far as we can go. We need more content for them. We need more information for them. We need to teach these kids to be skeptics rather than trying to convert adults or even just bring them into the fold. So my answer was a student organization. Since I teach college, that was the logical choice, was to get college students involved, everything from graduate students to freshmen. And then my hope is to start those organizations even at the high school and junior high and even elementary level. I can mark my moment of discovering skepticism. That was when someone visited my high school psychology class and pretended to be a magician. He was pretending to do real magic and conjuring and mind reading for about an hour, and then he broke the news to us that he was just a magician, he wasn't a psychic, and he came from the Bay Area Skeptics. And he kind of said, well, look, I'm part of this organization that is trying to teach that this is just tricks, that it's not really magic. He told us about the challenge, and the challenge was a challenge to prove that you had supernatural powers. At the time, it was about $10,000, I think, was what James Randi was offering. And this was before the days of the James Randi Educational Foundation. And this challenge was kind of new, but it had been offered for a few years, and nobody had claimed it. And I thought that was amazing. Nobody had claimed this money. You know, if there was real psychic power, it just seemed obvious to me that somebody should claim the money. Of course, now it's a $1 million challenge that the James Randi Educational Foundation offers. And still no one's won. Nobody's even made it past the preliminary challenge, which is a challenge that the people who apply for it help design. I think that introducing young people to critical thinking in many ways is activism, because it's not present in all of the curricula in schools. It's not everywhere. And what I think that these students, these Woo Fighters, can do, the initial group is kind of a set of graduate students and undergraduate students in experimental psychology. So they're very well trained in research methods and critical thought. Of course, they're recruiting from all over campus. But the idea here is to also train those students better even to teach this. And I envision an organization who wants to do more than just walk around, you know, wearing Bigfoot costumes and shaking people's hands and saying, hey, we're here, let's think critically. But also maybe going into high schools and junior highs and even elementary schools and doing science shows and, you know, maybe even doing research about what types of shows work, what types of demonstrations, what types of critical thinking exercises get kids to actually think. Don't just wow them and make them laugh or make them go ooh and ah, but get them interested in not just science, but in critical thinking, in thinking for themselves, in trying to solve problems, you know, Scooby-Doo style.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour of bad research. Cognitive psychologist and university lecturer Barbara Drescher joins us to discuss the common mistakes scientists make and what happens to the science when their research goes wrong. And on Speaking Up, journalist David Dobbs explains the case against Mark Hauser, a prominent Harvard evolutionary biologist who was recently found guilty of scientific misconduct. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Yeah, I am suddenly reminded of the Ladies Who Do Skepticism, a group in the UK.
Janice Bennion.
They are wonderful, wonderful people who said, right, okay, if the skeptics in the pub doesn't match up, let's move it into venues that we are comfortable with, whether it be the library, the cafe, the children's park. It encouraging diversity, encouraging creativity in how you can have opportunities to get together, and it, yeah, opening up to, okay, let's be creative with it and don't be afraid to be creative with it. And the Ladies Who Do Skepticism are an excellent example of that. Oh, and the QED conference that's coming up, they're quite a bit of a driving force behind that, so I encourage people to check that out as well.
And their keynote speaker?
Yeah.
Eugenie Scott.
Absolutely.
I do kind of want to speak to the positive here for a second. I've been involved in skepticism, whether you call it a movement or a mob or... I don't know, Revolutionary Party, who the hell knows. I've been involved now for about 12, 13 years, somewhere in that note. And when I first got involved, the demographics were very, very different. I was at a CFI conference that was here in Atlanta in, I want to say, 2001. And it was very, very white, very, very male, and very, very old. There were women there, but they were mostly the wives of the men that were there to actually participate in the conference. This is 9 years ago. Since then, there has been a huge sea change in the skeptics movement, mob, whatever. On this question, you know, 10 years ago, if you ask somebody in the skeptics movement, name a famous female skeptic, they might be able to come up with Sue Blackmore. Maybe a name or two otherwise. That was pretty much about it, you know. And now, of course, you know, you have all these women, including yourselves, who are doing fantastic work in the skeptics movement. We have come a long, long, long way. Are we perfect? No, not even close to perfect. Perfection is, you know, never going to be reached, but, you know, the most we can do is try. But I'm wondering, are we reaching the point now where we've done what we can do? This is going to sound bad, I think. Where we've done what we can do, but we're running up against broader issues with women in society. And one thing that's been very interesting for me during this entire panel, we've been here now for 50-odd minutes, and I've yet to hear somebody say the word feminism.
I am a feminist. I have no problem calling myself a feminist. But I think you've got to take skepticism and critical thinking into feminism. And you've got to hold those theories accountable with the same fervor that we hold other theories accountable. And then once we do that, then people won't be able to attack it.
And I think that's something that we do need to do more of, and Kylie mentioned it, being creative. But not only being creative, I do think that sometimes, and I may be in the minority here, sometimes you have to ignore the obstacles. Move on. Get your own radio show, start your own podcast, write for Skeptical Inquirer, start submitting stuff, talk to other people. Yeah. Because these problems are going to continue to exist, and we can work on them at the same time as just going out and doing it. What do you want to tell women who are thinking about getting into the skeptical community, but they see all of this animosity, they see the negativity? What do you tell them?
How many words did you say?
I don't think I said words.
No, there's no limit.
Oh. But I could do that. 140 characters for those who tweet.
Great. I would say that it is a very welcoming movement. And as far as, you know, level playing field sort of movements, it very much is so. It's a very welcoming community. Ideas are celebrated for the most part. And come on in. We're pretty nice mostly.
And I think work product is respected. If you show up and you actually have valid work product, you'll get respect.
Hi, my name's Dr. Rachel Dunlop. I'm also known as Dr. Rachie, and I'm a research scientist from Sydney, Australia. I work in aging research, mostly in heart disease research, but I also look at Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and motor neuron disease, which is also known as Lou Gehrig's. I'm particularly interested in looking at Lou Gehrig's disease because I'm working with a gentleman who has found what seems to be an environmental trigger for motor neuron disease or Lou Gehrig's. And this involves a fascinating problem looking at blue-green algae. So that's my main area of research at the moment, and it's fascinating stuff. And science is something that I love to do. It takes me all around the world. And most importantly, this research is something that might help us eventually find a cure for motor neuron disease or Lou Gehrig's disease. And currently there is no cure. There's no treatment for that. And there are two types of motor neuron disease. There's one called familial, which means that it's genetically linked. So if you have the genes, then it's likely that you'll get the disease. But that's only about 10% of cases are linked to the gene. About 90% of them occur what is called sporadically, which means there's no explanation. Nobody knows why. It just happens. And so we're desperately trying to find some sort of intervention for these people because at the moment there's nothing for them. And it's common for you to be diagnosed and then to die 2.5 years later. So it's a rapid onset to death. It's a tragic disorder. And it's something that a lot of people around the world who I'm collaborating with are working on furiously at the moment to see if we can find a cure. And this environmental link that we're looking at, which is this blue-green algae, we think might be a very important piece of the puzzle.
I think in many ways it's like anything. In the end, you have to start saying to yourself, well, what's more important, the product that you do and the work that you do and the satisfaction it brings you? Yeah, you got to do it for you in the end. Isn't that where most of us get our happiness from?
What group or, you know, any organization have you ever been a part of where everybody's, you know, happy with each other and likes everyone all the time? That's just an impossible world to be in. And this is probably for better, not for worse, not any different than those kind of groups, except I think the positives do outweigh the negatives, and the evidence of some of the amazing things that are happening and the work product that's being created. And it's just an exciting time to be a part of skepticism and critical thinking, and that has to do with everybody who's contributing. So, you know, those little annoyances are just that, and like in any situation, they'll fade away, and the important things are what are going to stand out in the end anyway, and anybody can be a part of it, so you should do so.
And that's our time. Thanks very much to everybody for being here. This is an important conversation.
Thank you, Desiree.
This gender conversation has been going on for years, and it'll probably be happening for many, many more. So while we're figuring out ways to make science and skepticism more inclusive or attractive to women, and while we're bringing critical thinking into different communities where women are, let's remember that there are a bunch of women who are already here, regardless of the obstacles, and their contributions are pretty amazing. You can find links to some of the projects that our guest told you about in the show notes at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you can also click to show your support on Facebook, on Twitter, or on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever.
a race shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.